The briefing is brought to you in association with the Sustainable Cities in Action Forum at Expo City Dubai. The Sustainable Cities in Action Forum at Expo City Dubai is a place for city leaders, developers, architects and designers to come together and innovate for the future of urban spaces. It's an opportunity for the Global South to convene in the Global South. It's a testbed for real-world solutions that will shape the future of people and planet. You can hear from the innovative thinkers and inspirational voices that drove the narrative at this year's edition by listening to Monocle's special episodes of The Briefing, recorded live at Expo City Dubai in March. Find and listen to the shows now at monocle.com or wherever you get your podcasts. The Sustainable Cities in Action Forum 2024. Collaborate, innovate, transform.
You're listening to The Briefing, first broadcast on the 26th of July 2021 on Monocle 24. The Briefing is brought to you in association with Novartis.
Hello and welcome to The Briefing, coming to you live from Studio One here at Midori House in London. I am Markus Hippi.
And I'm Chris Termack. Coming up on today's program.
The only path forward to a durable, lasting, and just end to the conflict is through negotiation, is through a political agreement, and ultimately is through compromise.
The U.S. Secretary of State, Antony Blinken, says compromise is the only way to end Afghanistan's conflict. But is the Taliban intent on reconciliation?
Also ahead, we'll unpack a big week of political wrangling in Washington, D.C. And Monocle's Alexei Korolev will tell us why the Austrians are so fond of cash.
Plus, Nick Manise will have an urbanism roundup for us. What's on your radar this week, Nick?
Well, we'll be looking at Seoul's rental bike boom and public space in San Francisco.
Looking forward to that. Thanks very much, Nick. All that right here on The Briefing with me, Chris Termack.
And me, Markus Hippi.
The United Nations has warned that Afghanistan is on the brink. Almost two decades after US-led forces entered the conflict to counter Taliban advances, the fundamentalist militia are once again taking ground across the country, with reports that civilian casualties are rising by the day. In response, the embattled government in Kabul has imposed a month-long curfew in the hope that it will stop the Taliban from taking major urban centers. Let's get more on this now with Paul Rogers, International Security Advisor at Open Democracy. Paul is a regular contributor here on Monocle 24. Paul, let's start with this UN report, record number of civilian casualties as foreign troops are withdrawing. And also, it struck me that the nature of these civilian casualties, how these are happening, is changing. The fighting is taking on a more distinctly Afghan fighting, Afghan quality. How is that impacting realities on the ground?
It's impacting them very strongly. You're absolutely correct in what you say about the nature of the casualties. Basically, foreign airstrikes of any sort have caused very few casualties, civilian casualties, because there are very few of them. What is happening mostly is lots of conflict across rural areas, now coming towards the cities. Essentially, Kandahar is one which is really concerned. That's Kandahar city, not the province. And you're getting many civilians killed as the Taliban bit by bit take over. Their control of the country probably extends to more than half of the provinces, including substantial ones, and it includes many of the provinces around the borders. This also means they're now controlling major border crossings, particularly ones with Iran and also Pakistan down in the southeast. They also now control the Wakhan corridor, which is crucially important geopolitically, because that's that long finger of Afghanistan which goes right through to China. So it actually provides a direct land connection, although not very passable at present, between the two countries. And the Taliban took control of that in the last 3 or 4 days. So essentially, bit by bit, the Taliban taking over, but inevitably, there are very heavy civilian casualties, and the UN reckons that they've more or less doubled per month in the last 6 months. It's as bad as that, essentially.
Paul, what do you expect, looking at the situation evolving and Taliban making inroads as far as the border with China? Would you expect, for example, China to be pulled into this conflict?
Not directly, but it is a hugely significant move. The point is that if China recognizes that it has an easier route into Afghanistan, not principally for troops, but much more on the economic side because of the huge mineral resources and the rest, and remember that China has already invested heavily in Afghanistan, if it basically can do some sort of deal with the Taliban, assuming, as China probably does, that the Taliban sooner or later will take full control, then China could be a major direct player. And the point is, while it'd be costly to build a connection on the eastern side of the border, it's not that far, about 100 kilometers from the Karakoram Highway, which is already very much being expanded. And China is perfectly capable of building certainly a 9 or 10 month year open serious road link through into Afghanistan. If they were able to do that in the next 3 or 4 years, it would actually alter the geopolitics of the region. But that depends hugely on whether China can negotiate agreement with an income Taliban control, which basically also prevents the Taliban allowing people to go into China to fight with the Uyghurs against the Chinese government. So it's a complicated geopolitics. But that small news point of the Taliban taking over that corridor is actually very significant.
Well, Paul, complicated geopolitics,
absolutely,
as you say. Is there a... Which one do you feel at this point that China is the major geopolitical actor that we need to worry about? There seem to be so many potentially involved as foreign troops are pulling out.
Not yet, but it could well be. That's the point I'm making. I mean, the major actors at present, regionally, obviously Iran, but that's more in the west of Afghanistan. And Iran is not particularly friendly with the Taliban. It goes right back to the killing of those diplomats, 20 years or so ago. And the Iranians are very cautious. But on the other hand, it's an important trading partner. The Iranians really worry about the amount of opium which comes over into their own country from Afghanistan, and they will maintain influence in Herat and other cities to the extent they can. Pakistan is obviously highly significant. The Indians are hugely worried that the Taliban will take over because they will aid the connect with Pakistan. And then you have the Russians as well, who are always looking for the main chance. And they in turn will be concerned about the potential rising power of China. And we already know that there have been Taliban delegations in Beijing in recent months talking informally with the Chinese. So while it is not the big one at present, I suspect it's going to be the one to watch in the coming months if and when the Taliban take full control.
Exactly. Now, Paul, we mentioned already the embattled government in Kabul has imposed a month-long curfew, hoping that it will stop the Taliban from taking major urban centres. How do you expect the situation to evolve? Is the government at the moment just trying to delay something that's inevitable?
I think it probably is, but how long the delay will be is far more difficult to tell. The Taliban do not seem to be in any hurry to basically take Kabul, which of course is the key. And they have to contend with various militias. The Northern Alliance may well regroup. You have basically individual ethnic groups who feel really threatened by the Taliban, like the Hazara, who are about 2 million strong, although mostly in a rural location. There are quite a few in Kabul, and they're forming their own militias. So it would not be easy to take over completely. So the Taliban may well bide their time, possibly even until next spring, although I rather doubt that. On the other hand, the collapse could be very quick because, as we've been seeing, the Americans are withdrawing. Virtually everything will be gone by the end of August, apart from the troops defending the diplomats and the rest. And the United States is reluctant to invest too heavily in a long-term remote air war to maintain the Afghan government in power. I suspect whatever they say in public, Washington is resigned to the fact that the Taliban will be in pretty full control of the country within a year, which of course is disastrous in so many ways, not least for women right across the country and for many Afghans who've returned to Afghanistan to help build the country.
Thanks very much for that, Paul. That was Paul Rogers from Open Democracy. Now here's Marcus with the day's other news headlines.
Thanks, Chris. Tunisia's president has sacked the prime minister and suspended parliament following violent protests across the country. President Kais Saied announced that he would take charge with help from a new prime minister, but his political opponents say the move amounts to a coup. America's leading infectious disease expert has warned that coronavirus cases are surging among the unvaccinated. Dr. Anthony Fauci says the Delta variant of COVID-19 was driving the spike in parts of the US with low vaccination rates. He added that officials were considering revising mask guidance. Italy has asked European states to send firefighting aircraft to help tame fires that have swept across parts of the island of Sardinia. The Italian Foreign Ministry says the Civil Protection Authority had issued the request and that it was grateful for help that was being provided by Italy's neighbours. And finally, Leicestershire has become the last English county to adopt its own flag. It features a rendering of the territory's adopted animal, the fox, in full sprint below a five-petal flower. You can find out much more about Leicestershire's new flag by heading to monocle.com/minute. Those are the day's headlines. Now over to you, Chris.
Thanks very much, Marcus. Now, to say that US presidents from Barack Obama to Donald Trump haven't always seen eye to eye would be a massive understatement. But they have always agreed on one thing: the need to overhaul America's creaky infrastructure. Now it's finally looking like that might become a reality. In Washington, D.C., a massive infrastructure bill that is also a key priority for President Joe Biden is gearing up for an important week in the U.S. Senate. Lawmakers on both sides of the political aisle are racing to reach a deal that could also mark a rare bipartisan compromise in a very divided U.S. Congress. Now I'm joined on the line by Suzanne Lynch, Washington correspondent at the Irish Times. Good morning, Suzanne, over there. Tell us a little bit more about this bill. It's not everything that Joe Biden wants at this stage, but how much does the bill cover?
Well, this is a bill of about $1 trillion or so. We're waiting to hear the final details. And Joe Biden, if you like, shook hands on this with some members of the Republican Party in the Senate and Democrats a few weeks ago when he hosted them in the White House. But since then, and they still haven't been able to get the details of this over the line. Some of the Republicans were concerned and quite annoyed that it seemed to be linked to a more expansive bill. And Joe Biden had said that both were in tandem, and then he had to go and clarify those remarks. But what's been happening over the last week or so is that we've had closed door negotiations on the Hill with a group of Republican senators and Democrats trying to thrash out details of this. It's your traditional infrastructure plan in a lot of ways. It covers things like roads, like broadband in this case, and things like public transport. And as you say there, I think there is a kind of an understanding here in the US that those kind of things are what needs investment. We're in an economic climate where there's a lot of government spending being sanctioned at the moment. And Biden is keen that infrastructure gets a slice of that pie.
So it is indeed a rare moment that it looks like Democrats and Republicans can work together on something. But is the devil this time in the details? What are some of the more controversial details in this bill?
Yeah, one way of looking at this is that one of the sticking points appears to be the idea of public transport, mass transit, as it's called here. And what we're seeing is that a lot of the Republican senators, most of whom represent areas of the country that are more rural, not always, but a lot of them do, and they are less keen on investing in public transport because obviously that's an issue that benefits cities, it benefits urban centres, which are generally represented by Democrats. So you're having a kind of a showdown over this issue. What Republicans, many of the Republicans negotiating this want is more money for highways, for roads that would benefit their constituents, their districts across America, not transit. Now, Joe Biden is known to many as Amtrak Joe. He is a president who took the train every day when he was in the Senate from his home in Delaware to Washington. And he recently appeared at a celebration of the 50th anniversary of Amtrak, the train company here. So he has made it clear that he wants investment in public transport to be part of this. So that appears to be one of the sticking points now. How far Republicans are not happy to think too much of this money is going to public transport. So they're down to negotiation on this. So I think that's going to be a big focus of discussions this morning here in Washington when these negotiations get going again.
Well, Suzanne, take us a little bit further forward. This is also, not Joe Biden's only plan that he has in place. He also has what's almost called a human infrastructure bill. What's that about? Where do you presumably it's going to get more controversial from here on out.
Yeah. So this is the kind of second part of this. And it's a much bigger bill. It's a $3.5 trillion package, so a huge package. The key thing about this package is that Democrats hope to pass that through a process called reconciliation in the Senate. And that would allow them to push through this legislation without Republican votes. It's using a trick, a kind of an accounting trick, if you like, that it's to do with a budget. And there's certain rules where you can just use this procedure called reconciliation. So unlike this immediate package of $1 trillion, they wouldn't need Republican votes. So on paper, yes, that would be easy. Democrats could just pass this. However, Democrats have a tiny, tiny majority. The Senate is split 50-50, and they need Kamala Harris to cast a tie-breaking vote. So you've got a couple of Democrats, in particular Joe Manchin of West Virginia and Kyrsten Sinema of Arizona, who are not happy with some of the elements in this proposed $3.5 trillion budget, broader plan. And so that is a problem for Democrats coming down the road. Also, once the Senate decide, over in the House, the other chamber, and there are some Democrats, it's the opposite problem, if you like, on the left, on the far left of the party, who want more in that package. So they've got the problem now that they have to keep the more moderate Democrats, more to the centre, people like Joe Manchin and Kyrsten Sinema, happy in the Senate. But then when they go to the House, they have to keep the more left-wing politicians like Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez, for example, and some of her allies on the Hill. They'll be wanting as much spending as possible and specific kind of spending in that package. So look, that's a broader priority. It's a more longer term priority with the Democrats. What they're going to try and do is get this infrastructure first part done, or at least open votes on that this week. Summer is approaching. Both chambers are going to be going off their districts for an extended period throughout August. So they're going to have to get progress, at least on this first bill. And we're hoping even to get some movement on that today in Washington.
Suzanne, thank you very much for that update. That was Suzanne Lynch in Washington, D.C. You are listening to The Briefing on Monocle 24.
Novartis is proud to partner The Briefing on Monocle 24. Novartis is a company that is committed to reimagining medicine. The global healthcare leader intent on changing the practice of medicine, Novartis has been exploring uncharted frontiers in science for more than a century. Today, the company is working on breakthrough treatments that push the boundaries of human understanding in biology, data science, and engineering to develop and deliver therapies that help people live longer and healthier lives around the world. Novartis, reimagining medicine.
You are back with The Briefing on Monocle 24. Now, at a time when most of Europe is switching to cashless payments, helped in no small part by successive coronavirus lockdowns that moved many businesses online, Austrians are holding firm to the cash in their pockets. The country's leaders have even opposed a plan by the European Commission to cap cash payments in the bloc at 10,000 euros. Monocle's Alexei Korolev in Vienna has more.
For years, the European Union has been criticised for allowing vast amounts of questionable money to circulate inside the bloc. But it says this won't be tolerated anymore. Last week, the European Commission announced a bold new plan to prevent money laundering and terrorism financing. One of its central planks is limiting cash payments and transfers at 10,000 euros. Most EU members seem to be on board, but there is one dissenting voice.
Ganz prinzipiell, was die Maßnahmen gegen Geldwäsche und Terrorismusfinanzierung betrifft, da müssen wir uns natürlich weiterentwickeln. Da ist es sehr, sehr wichtig, dass wir auf neue Erkenntnisse Rücksicht nehmen. Ich
glaube, that's Austrian Finance Minister Gernot Blümel laying out his country's opposition to cash restrictions. And this is his statement in English, provided to Monocle 24. From Austria, there is a clear yes to the fight against money laundering and terrorism financing, and an equally clear no to a tax on cash. Cash gives people a sense of security, independence and freedom. We want to preserve this freedom for people. There should be no criminalization of private individuals who use cash.
My name is Guido Schäfer, and I'm an associate professor at the Department of Economics at VU. As a matter of fact, there is a substantial share in the population which has a strong preference for cash. So I would say about half of the people only paying cash or always paying cash when they can do that. And so I think in that sense, it's a politically sensitive issue in Austria, because if you try to limit the use of cash, that's not politically popular among a lot of people, and particularly not among the voters of the Conservative Party, which is in government right now.
According to the nation's central bank, Austrians have taken out billions of euros in banknotes during the pandemic to be stashed at home or in bank safes.
Where this really comes from, I think...
Professor Schäfer at the Vienna University of Economics and Business says there are many reasons for this.
I think generally speaking, payment patterns are partly driven by policy, partly driven by history, and partly driven by habits. Talk about Germany and Austria. I think it still has to do with the traumatic experience of the 20th century, when the financial system was wiped out twice following the World Wars. So although it's been a long time now since then, luckily, this sums up to a situation where cash is still very popular, and abolishing it or limiting the use of cash is something which particularly the People's Party would not have high on its agenda.
Austria is adamant there is no direct link between cash and crime, and Professor Schäfer agrees.
I mean, as a matter of fact, I would be interested in seeing real the evidence supporting that, because to the best of my knowledge, there is actually very weak evidence between the use of a means and of payment and, let's say, illegal activities, right? I mean, just take, for example, a comparison between Austria and Sweden. In Sweden, people pay a lot with payment cards. Still, for example, if you look at the shadow economy, it's significantly bigger in Sweden than in Austria, probably for other reasons, such as higher taxes or other things. So I think if it was true that by limiting the use of certain means of payments, you would get a more moral society, I would be totally in favor of that. But that's too good to be true, in my opinion.
Many restaurants and shops in Austria still don't accept cards. And whether or not the EU adopts the proposed changes, cash is here to stay in this country. But so are its inevitable downsides. It can be stolen or damaged, or there may simply be not enough of it to go around. For Monocle in Vienna, I'm Alexei Korolov.
Thanks to Alexei for that report. And now I'm wondering, you, Chris, you were also listening to that story, and you happen to be the most Austrian member of today's production team. My first question to you, how much cash do you have in your pockets today?
You know, weirdly, Marcus, I actually have euros, dollars and pounds in my pocket, embarrassingly. I just haven't really taken them out since the pandemic began.
You sound like a typical Austrian then. Did you agree on that sentiment? How do you explain all that was happening in Austria? We just heard that to have cash gives you the feeling of security, independence and freedom. Do you agree on that?
You know, it's interesting because they brought both Germany and Austria into that. And that was my experience, in both cases. So politically, it's quite interesting that Austria is taking a line that Germany isn't by actually, you know, coming down hard on this law. But actually, both countries, yes, very much have that sense that, you know, you go into restaurants in Austria and Germany, you still don't necessarily pay by card. You can't necessarily pay by card. I am, of course, curious now that the pandemic has happened, whether that will be slowly changing to some degree. But I think it's just so much of a tradition there that people are it's a privacy thing. It's worries that many people have. It's hard to break that.
It's interesting to see if that's going to change sometime. Well, on today's edition of The Briefing, we're also joined by another person in the studio, Monocle's Nick Manis, who loves his bank and credit cards. But you're not here to talk about that. You're here to talk about your urbanism stories for this week. Good afternoon.
Good afternoon. And I think there is an urbanism thread here in terms of accessibility to the city and the role that, I don't know, this isn't one of my stories, just to be clear, but the role that, you know, the rise of tap and go has had on obviously perhaps pushing some people out who don't have access to a credit card or a banking system. So there is a little bit of tension there about, yeah, how to ensure that people get equal access to the city. That's my two cents. Mm. That being said, if a place doesn't have tap and go, I'm ropeable.
Okay, but anyway, your first story for today is actually very much about money and finances.
It is.
We're going to South Korea.
We are going to South Korea, and I guess we can start with that money and finances thread first. So basically, Seoul's bike rental program, hugely popular, massively successful. They've hit 3 million users this year. That's about a third of the city's population. That's 3 million individuals using the bikes at different times. And this popularity has actually caused... force the government into the red because they're spending so much money to keep it funding to roll out new bikes. I think, let me just get the numbers here. They're planning to add 3,000 more bikes, 500 more rental stations by the end of this year. And it's amounting to losses of about 7 million euros per annum. And it does have a plan. It is planning to mitigate this cost by selling advertisement space on the bikes. But it's one of those funny ones where a really, really good thing is very, very expensive.
Interesting, yeah. Well, let's move on from that a little bit. I like, though, that we started with a finance angle. Let's turn to San Francisco. San Francisco is keeping its parklets.
Yeah, so it's one of those things we saw pop up in cities across the globe over the past year. I mean, parklets have been a thing for a long time. I think the first official parklet was actually in San Francisco. But obviously, with businesses looking to expand their offering in outdoor areas, we've seen more, you know, outdoor dining on footpaths and in parking spaces, and obviously the planning departments in different cities need to legislate for this to make sure it's just not an absolute free-for-all. And rather, I guess, than returning to the status quo, San Francisco's approved an ordinance for the pandemic parklets, as they're called, to stay, which means that, I guess, businesses can continue to operate in these areas, pandemic or not.
I do love this story, Nick, I got to say, just because there's so many cities that are actually doing this, which is maybe interesting. It's not just San Francisco, but we're slowly seeing those kind of cities that didn't have an outdoor culture starting to ease their restrictions.
Absolutely. And I think the thing I particularly like about San Francisco, is that they are, I mean, it feels weird to say, but they are closing the parklets between midnight and 7 a.m. So you have to bring your furniture in off the street, which might sound like a nuisance, but I actually do think it's a generally good thing for the city. From my experience in Perth, I've seen, you know, how easy it is for, I guess, litter and debris, just general urban debris, to build up on these spaces when you do leave urban furniture in them. And I think this is just a good way to give a little bit of, I guess, management responsibility back to the shop owners and say, hey, you're also responsible for helping to keep these streets clean and tidy and presentable and make them enticing.
Let's continue to the Nordics, then, to Denmark. A big announcement. Copenhagen is to be the world capital of architecture in 2023. How significant is this, and how big of a win is this for Denmark?
Well, I think it's quite good. So it comes off the back of Rio de Janeiro just wrapped up as host last week of the World Congress of Architects, who work with UNESCO to designate the world capital of architecture. So the capital hosts the Congress, and this is every 3 years. So Denmark's going to be hosting it in 2023. Rio was 2020, which has since become 2021. It's significant, I guess, maybe less so for Copenhagen, other than perhaps bringing in architects from around the world. But what's important is that it does pull in these architects from everywhere. The Congress, is a non-government organisation that works to, I guess, promote the exchange of ideas and new concepts and technologies and discuss policies. And I think Copenhagen's a really good place to pull people together to talk about these things. I mean, this city is so well run, you know, from pedestrian and cycle infrastructure through to buildings. I mean, you look at Bjark Engel's Copenhill, that's a perfect example of, you know, a building that is, you know, at once a waste disposal facility, a power plant, but also, you know, a ski slope. So you've got these urban amenities, but also, you know, urban infrastructure rolled into one. So I think that is what's significant about this. It's the lessons that are going to be on show there for the designers coming there.
It will be an interesting one to visit, that's for sure. One final one, let's just get your thoughts quickly on plans for Melbourne's M Pavilion to be unveiled.
Yeah, so, I mean, this is meant to be Australia's answer to the Serpentine Pavilion. Obviously, it has been running for several years. I mean, the likes of Rem Koolhaas has designed a pavilion and Amanda Levitt from London. So it's quite an exciting announcement whenever the new design is unveiled. And the Venetian Architecture Practice Map Studio have been appointed the designers again this year. They were meant to design it last year, but again, didn't happen. So we've seen, I guess, the initial renders and sketches for these. It's this sort of steel lattice structure. It's kind of odd. It's one of those ones where I can't really work out exactly what's happening, and it's going to be, and maybe that's actually the most enticing thing about it, because I think to be able to understand, you're going to have to go, and you're going to have to go visit Melbourne. So hopefully they're out of lockdown there. Designers from around Australia and just general punters can come, have a look, wander around, really just enjoy architecture in a beautiful urban environment.
I was going to say, Nick, I hope this is one of those that I'm sure you're going to be looking forward to when we can get back to travel slowly, actually visiting in person as well. So I'm sure.
Absolutely. I mean, this is a thing I would go to every year. It's a real destination and a real big event. So significant for Australia.
Thanks very much, Nick. That was Monocle's Nick Manise. And that's all for this edition of The Briefing. It was produced by Rhys James, researched by Sophie Monaghan-Coombs. And our studio manager today was Louis Allen. The Briefing is back tomorrow at the same time. That's midday in London, or 7 a.m. if you're listening in Washington, D.C. I'm Chris Chermak.
And I am Markus Hippi. Thanks for listening.